ready to start recording and our proceedings. This is day two, January 23rd, and I'm still talking to Fred. And did you remember the name of that high school?
The high school where I went to high school?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Omaha North.
Omaha North, okay.
But that wasn't what I was...
Oh, you were trying to...
I was forgetting the name of the chemistry...
Chemistry instructor. Instructor at high school that got you inspired.
Oh, boy, that's right.
Okay, well, if you think of it, we can even correspond
I should
by,
have asked
by
Jimmy.
Email
that's
if
right.
we want to... So you've got some of the proceedings or the little program booklets from the early
I thought I was going to look up Jack O'Neill, but no, let's talk about other things.
Okay.
About his being the first direct program.
Yeah. Did you know if he published that in the literature anywhere?
I think it's an analytical chemistry.
Okay, I can search that.
In 1959 is what I remember.
Yeah, so much of it's available electronically. Last night, during supper, we talked about a few topics. I just wanted to revisit them for a second. He said that Babu Venkatarghavan had gone to Washington University in St. Louis to get some pointers or a little bit of background on the use of the deck computer. So he would have
PDP
8. Yeah. So this would have been
the one before that was the I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that would have been at the Mass Spec Resource at the Med School.
Right.
Bill Sherman was
involved. Bill Sherman.
Yeah.
But, and that was, 1965.
Okay. And they had a guy, there was two people that were involved in that. One of them is this fellow by the name of Don Rempel. I don't know if Don
Rempel,
R-E-M-P-E-L.
Well, he came with Mike from Nebraska.
Okay, but he actually was started out at Washington University. He was in Arizona. He was doing a graduate work at Washington U about the time. As a matter of fact, he was associated with some of that activity in the med school. Then there was also this fellow that started TechNavent.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Rich Berger. I can't remember if it was Rich or Phil. I know a couple of Bergers.
No, Phil Berger.
Phil Berger.
Phil Berger, yeah.
Yeah. So but, Phil, was Phil on the...
No, but if I get my magnifying glass, this book goes back 40 years.
So you've got this little black book where you keep the names of
that I used to be able to read.
I need a magnifying glass to read that, Fred.
You're not the only one.
Does it just keep a log of all these various people that you...
Well, I've just written people's names down because I'm terrible at remembering names. And, sometimes I can find them right away, and sometimes they just never show up. Oh, here's Wash U. Well, Oliver Lowry, but... And Dave...
There's a guy named Denny Beer that was there for a while. I don't know if that rings any bells.
These are all guys that... No, these aren't the names that I couldn't remember. Peter Gasper. They're not the names I could remember.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. And so this was pretty common in those days that you could, go to a quote kind of competitor in the business and kind of pick his brain and he'd help you out. And people were pretty cooperative that way.
Science is always well. My view of science has always been that way, but some places are better than others. But Wash U facility and their PDPA expertise, their expertise they developed that then became the PDPA is the way I remember it. They had a great deal to do with the original development of the PDPA.
Mm.
And there's some name like PGP-7I or something.
Yeah, they had a whole bunch of different...
Before that. But these guys were totally wonderful to me. I had a connection there, Oliver Lowry, who's...
L-A-U-R-Y?
L-O-W-R-Y. Oh, Oliver Lowry, who's a cousin of my mother's and who's who's famous at having more citations for one of his papers than anybody else.
One of those guys.
Well, you ask people there, they'll know Oliver Lowry in med school.
Sure.
Med school. But anyway, but these guys were wonderful, and I think they came over to see us too, but Babu went over there and they gave him everything. But somebody comes to our lab, well, maybe not Mike Gross, but...
Well, yeah.
If somebody comes to our lab and wants to learn about ECD, of course we show them.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
We did the first electrospray with FTMS.
Mm-hmm.
And got published in 1989 or something. Well, the first thing was that John Finn himself was tremendously helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Total details. And I didn't have the connections to get the ions into the mass spec, but Don Hunt did.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guys put our electrospray stuff into the back of the car, and they drove down to Virginia, and Jeff Chevalis helped him hook it on there, and they were going to stay for 3 or 4 days, and the weekend came, and Sunday night they got a spectrum.
Mm.
And we published that, of course. We published it with Don and Jeff. But, you know, that's what makes science fun.
Good. So that's your experience has been one that's fairly collegial and cooperative.
Oh, heavens. Yes. I mean, sure, we didn't invite people in to show them Electron Capture Association before we got the manuscript off to JCS. But did we talk about it? We talk about things at meetings.
So you came to Cornell, and there was a kind of a price to be paid in terms of the fact that a lot of what you thought you were going to bring with you wasn't going to happen. How long was it before you felt like you had gotten back to where, you know, essentially like kind of the point you would have been if you'd stayed at Purdue?
That's a good question.
Because you weren't getting, I think grant money started to get a little tighter, and the NIH wasn't as, or NSF were not as freewheeling with their money at that time, I think. And you had to wait a while. I mean, you got grants from the Army, but.
I had all sorts of different things to handle, but one thing, it was like going to Purdue. In 64, we started all sorts of things in research that I wasn't doing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I came here, we actually changed and started other things in the research program.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them had to do with the fact that we didn't have the same instrumentation. But, for example, this wonderful NIH grant to set up a big facility there, because we were sure that the computers were the next thing in mass spectrometry, we had gotten them to buy us a Sigma 5 computer.
Okay.
Well, because Babu thought that was the most wonderful thing in the world. And this was in 1966 or 7 that we ordered the computer, and it hadn't arrived when I left in 1968. It hadn't arrived yet.
So at Purdue.
At Purdue, but by the time we got here, and I had a much closer connection with Digital Equipment Corporation, and Babu was saying, oh, the Sigma 5 is outmoded. Well, now 3 years is a lot for computers.
Yeah.
PDP-11 is the real thing.
Yeah.
And I got my DEC friends to loan us a PDP-11. Well, the Sigma 5 took up a huge part of the room, and the PDP-11 was a few relay racks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, things like that really did make a big difference in... And it wasn't Purdue's fault, and it wasn't that we made a bad selection. And when John Bynum got there, he wasn't interested in the computer at all,
mm-hmm.
and so it just stayed boxed up,
mm-hmm.
which is no criticism of John.
Mm-hmm.
If they had put in, if somebody had left me something, and that's not my research
yeah.
program, I don't feel obligated to use
sure,
it.
Sure. So that's probably, you know, I would guess, maybe another 3 or 4 years, 4 or 5 years at Cornell before you kind of felt like your program was
no,
back at the...
No, if you... we had just gotten a collisional activation going at Purdue on the... Bendix time of flight.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first things I did, well, I told you yesterday about reversing the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was that we set up to do MS-MS on the magnetic sector instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for one reason, I didn't have a time of flight.
Right.
So I was trying to think of, it's just like the computer. I didn't have a time of flight, so we had to do it.
Yeah.
And yet, this looked like a tremendously exciting area,
mm-hmm.
and so, well, the publication I told you about, in which we did MS-MS on peptides,
mm-hmm.
putting a mixture of peptides in,
mm-hmm.
And getting sequences on the individual, that's a 1970 publication,
mm-hmm.
and so we really had things going. Oh, one thing that was great was that all of my research group came with me.
Okay.
Yeah, so that I had good hands here, and I got some good people when I first got here,
mm-hmm.
and so Cornell had already had a AEI MS-9
okay.
double focusing
sure.
instrument for
mm-hmm.
service work,
mm-hmm.
so there was high resolution going.
Mm-hmm.
And the RMH2 took a while to get here, the story I told you
mm-hmm.
yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say in a year we were really going again.
Okay, so it didn't take too long, but it was a little bit of a setback in terms.
Yeah,
of
but it was really the thing that's hard to explain is that how. Getting into a new situation with all new relationships and can start you into brand new areas.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. It's just something I've talked to people about who are considering moving
mm-hmm.
that I can't. I have a hard time explaining. But if we go down my list of publications for that time. We have a kind of landmark papers in several fields within the next few years after that.
Mm-hmm.
What is modern MS-MS, at least from my selfish point of view, traces back to that work we did those first few years
mm-hmm.
because nobody else was doing much of that kind of thing. And that was our first paper on this self-training interpretation and retrieval system,
mm-hmm.
which as an example of one of the first artificial intelligence programs.
Mm-hmm.
That was a whole new area of research. Yeah, we were really doing, we had started a little of that at Purdue, But we did it in a big way here, and though we did some of it on the PDP-11, we have a very strong relationship with the Cornell Computer Center, mm-hmm. and so we did most of it on the big IBM, and that's turned out to be something I'm very proud of, mm-hmm. and our data, our file of reference mass spectra, our first collection of that published by John Wiley that mm-hmm. I did in collaboration with Einar Stenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
He's a person I think is one of the real pioneers of organic mass spectrometry and GCMS. The jet separator was his,
mm-hmm.
And Ragnar
Rehaga. Yeah.
And anyway, in 1969 we brought out the first edition of that, and with 8,600 mass spectra,
mm-hmm.
and in 1974 we had 19,000, and the latest edition we've done has 600,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't show you, we have a couple of offices in there where my two venerable ladies measure mass spectra and put them in the computer.
Oh my.
And
so this is a continuing process? So
something. Stenhagen and his colleague Abrahamson both died long ago.
Mm, so yes.
It's been my project, but National Institutes of Standards and Technology is up to 193,000,
mm-hmm.
and we're up. We're over 600,000. Let's put it that way.
So this is an area of competition you feel between you and
sure.
You and the other guys.
Well, since we have, I've forgotten, we have more than half of the spectra that they have in their 193,000 are also in ours. I would say since we have 600,000, the 600,000 actually includes all of theirs,
mm-hmm.
of which less than 100,000 come from them,
mm-hmm.
and so I don't feel that they're really competitors.
Okay.
Except they have the U.S. government paying all their expenses,
right.
And I have my royalties paying all my expenses.
Royalties, okay, they must be sufficient to do that without too much trouble.
That's fine. And we use the Cornell Library, and our physical sciences library is one of the finest in the world. So mm-hmm. And the library is on the same floor. Go show you the library.
Speaking of royalties, when did you decide you wanted to do the interpretation of mass spectra book?
That came out of the short courses the American Chemical Society in 65, I think it was, started short courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that mine was one of the first three short courses. And it just happened to be that the guy that was running the short courses for the ACS went to graduate school with me. So
mm-hmm.
It was my real talent that got me this job, of course.
Oh, yes, definitely.
It's not what you know, but who you know.
So that was the impetus for trying to take all this information that you were providing in the short course and put it into a book form.
And then and the easiest way to write a book is to teach courses.
Mm-hmm.
And so we taught the short course many times.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've taught it 100 times now,
mm-hmm.
if you count.
Mm-hmm.
Courses and so forth. And so it just naturally turned into a book.
And then, so the first publication came out in, what, the late 60s then?
66.
66.
66.
And
73, 80, and 93.
And you're guesstimating probably 100,000 copies or so. Now, it's kind of interesting because that basically just discusses EI, electron ionization, as the method of getting gas phase ions, but it's still a popular item in the...
Well, Since you're a mass spectrometrist, I can tell you, the great advantage of electron ionization is you make an odd electron molecular ion. Mm-hmm. And so you get both even electron ion reactions and odd electron ion reactions. Mm-hmm. And odd electron ions are radical site reactions, and so they're more specific and they're of a different nature. And so you get not only twice as many types of reactions to use to characterize the structure, mm-hmm. but you get much more specific reactions. Mm-hmm. Even electron ions are more stable, so you've got to put more energy into them to make them fall apart, mm-hmm. and that means they have more chance to isomerize to something else. Mm-hmm. So it's as simple as that. And the nice thing about electron capture dissociation, to go have the wheel go all the way around and come back to where it started, mm-hmm. is that we finally have another method that puts in an odd electron, mm-hmm. and so electron capture dissociation can dissociate by odd electron ion reactions. We haven't exploited this at all, mm-hmm. except that it brings back the same chemistry.
Yeah, so in the traditional early ionization method by electron ionization, you get your odd electron ion by removing an electron from the molecule.
Got it.
But in electron capture, you get your odd electron ion by stuffing an electron.
Hey, man, so you got it.
So, like
and
you said,
people don't realize this, but isn't it neat?
Yes.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that you get from teaching courses, mm-hmm. is that you try to condense things down to what's sort of the simplest mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. And why should we ever give up good old electron ionization, which, mm-hmm. as you say, knocks an electron out of there, mm-hmm. Except that we could do it the other way, put an electron in.
So when did you get into the electron capture dissociation business? I mean, that is a form of ionization. When did that
come? Well, our first publication was 1998, so mm-hmm. It's pretty recent.
Yeah.
And the story, well, the story there is kind of interesting, too. For proteins, for large molecules and large biomolecules, obviously has, since NIH has always supported my work, biomolecules, it's because of this even electron ion problem. All of these wonderful methods, starting out with chemical ionization,
sure.
which is a wonderful method, and going through Fab, as you pointed out yesterday, mm-hmm. and electrospray and MALDI all give even electron ions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when we have been doing larger and larger peptides on the FTMS, mm-hmm. First FTMS was 84, and so we did Fab on the FTMS, and we're very proud of the fact we could get up to 2,000 molecular weight
sure.
peptides.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't, we don't take any credit for that. We were following Mickey Barber and those people.
Mm-hmm.
But then we wanted to dissociate these to find out the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried collisional activation, mm-hmm. and we tried multi-photon infrared multi-photon dissociation,
mm-hmm.
the CO2 laser you saw in there,
mm-hmm.
and we tried surface-induced dissociation,
mm-hmm.
Slamming various ways of slamming the ions into surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
We invented neutralization reionization mass spectrometry along about that time.
Mm-hmm.
Our first publication on that was actually 1980,
mm-hmm.
but that was in our big four sector instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a way you could actually get odd electrons into it, but it's a four sector instrument isn't what you want in everybody's lab.
Yes, right.
What other methods did we try? We tried excimer laser, mm-hmm. 193 nanometer photons. I said, gee, we're going to put in 6.4 eV of energy into that ion when it absorbs that photon. It's going to blow apart in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Rah! They came apart. They darn peptides would come apart in exactly the same way.
Oh, really?
Well, of course, if from a physical organic chemist point of view, a physical chemist point of view, you raise this ion to a certain energy level and let the energy equilibrate all randomly over the thing,
mm-hmm.
it's going to fall apart statistically.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
By hindsight, this is wonderful,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out that in this excimer laser thing with these very hot photons,
mm-hmm.
Once in a while, the people would see other ions. And it wasn't always the very best people that saw it. And when Roman Zubarev arrived...
How do you spell that?
Z-U-B-A-R-E-V.
Okay.
He's now a professor at Uppsala, University of Uppsala in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Roman, we've tried a variety of ways to figure out what's going on here. In fact, we are even having trouble making reproducible spectra.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I won't go through all the things of moonlight shining through the window and things like that that were making a difference here that we've gone through. But one of the things that we considered was it could be electrons that were, and we couldn't figure out why this was, but Roman said, I can test that by just putting on an extra pair of trapping electrodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in ICR, we trap the ions in the center
right.
of the magnetic field with positive electrodes, which keep the positive ions in there.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but of course, then if you have electrons in there, they see this positive
sure.
charge and they go roaring out of there.
Right.
And Roman says, I'll put another set of trapping electrodes and I'll make them negative.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can keep any electrons we get in there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did that, he found he could make these peaks get higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that what was happening is this $30,000 laser wasn't aimed perfectly, and it was hitting the inside of the metal surface of the ion cell, making electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roman put the old-fashioned filament electron gun back on, which actually electrons cost less than less than $30,000. In fact, it was the old gun that we'd had on the instrument when it first came, and it was sitting on a shelf. In fact, even the story, Kent Henry was a grad student.
Is it Kent?
Kent, K-E-N-T, Henry, as in Henry, was a grad student who'd already gotten his PhD. And I said, the last guy I think worked with that gun was Kent Henry. Why don't you call him up? So I called up Kent Henry. Kent says, oh, you find it on the right back side of the third shelf in the junk room behind the thus and so, and there it was. And Roman put it on there, and we have ECD spectra ever since.
So you inject electrons into the cell.
You have to trap the electrons. And so there are several things about it that the electron, here you have not just an ion, but a protein ion that has 10 or even 20 positive charges
right.
in it. And, gee, electron coming near it, well, of course it's going to go zinging into it. Why don't we ever see it? Well, the electron has to go slowly enough to turn around and be captured.
Mm-hmm.
And so Roman is very good at physics, and he measured energies of electrons, and he found that 1 volt electrons, that is going 1 volt kinetic energy,
mm-hmm.
had 3 orders of magnitude less chance of being captured
mm-hmm.
than the electrons he could make go as slowly as he could.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is another reason people hadn't observed it, is because when if you try to trap electrons, it's entirely the opposite of trapping.
Right.
And so there have been several ways to overcome this problem, but now it's pretty straightforward. Everybody uses electron cathode association. And the real problem was that you could only do it in the FTM. We could only do it in the FTMS.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Hunt's come up with a way to do it in water pools.
Mm-hmm.
And now, just at this last meeting, the guys at what used to be VG, maybe I guess it's part of Waters now.
Have come up with a
way to do it in an ion trap sort of thing. That's really a very clever thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's in Don Hunt's method, he has to use a great big anion. The first thing he used was anthracene minus,
mm-hmm.
and he could keep this from being knocked out of there. Of course, when an RF field is changing, it changes and throws electrons out long before it throws ions.
Mm, yes.
And what the ion trap people have done is, instead of having an RF sine wave, they put in a square wave. And so the voltage has totally changed in a nanosecond or something like that. And so the electron and the ion are both seeing this change, and they can get the electrons trapped next to the ions long enough for the capture to take place. And so, well, of course, we didn't do any of that, but the more the merrier.
Oh, yeah.
The more people use it. I say to the students, don't worry if you haven't done the experiment perfectly, because we've never gotten ECD if these guys had aimed the laser well enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, serendipity always, I think, plays a part in the research, and being open to a serendipitous result is part of progress, I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I've forgotten now, but I bet it was over a year after we noticed these peaks, and it might have been 2 years before we figured out what they were. And it was always a nagging thing. It was never kind of on the top of the burner, because, you know, you could say, well, somebody got a messy solution.
Yeah, it could be an impurity in the sample.
Or they didn't measure this right, or there could be something. So anyway, that was ECD.
So this kind of leads to an interesting point, and that is that, and I don't know if this is so true in other areas of the physical analytical sciences, but it just seems to me that every time mass spectrometry looks like it has hit a dead end, or it's limited in some way or another, somebody discovers something, and all of a sudden a whole new area of science, a whole new class of compounds, a whole new way of looking at the problem develops. And it just seems like there's this continual, you know, every 3, 4, 5 years some new idea comes along and it captures the imagination, and people take off with it, and then another couple of years something else comes along, and it just keeps rolling. You know, I mean, you, I think yourself at one time figured that electron ionization mass spec was, you know, the end of the road.
As I told you, 1956, yeah. I was out of it.
Yeah.
it was done.
it does. I mean, it just keeps reinventing itself. I don't know of any other technique that has that kind of...
NMR is certainly a parallel to that, and I think that's the point that Reinhardt makes in his book.
Mm-hmm.
But infrared is interesting in that when I first got into mass spec, at least locally, infrared was totally dominant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had 20 people in the group, and they were known across the Dow Chemical Company as the court of first and last resort for solving molecular problems and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, infrared really went into a total slump. And Fourier transform infrared gave them another three orders of magnitude sensitivity mm-hmm. and really kind of put them back on the map, but they don't compete. Their biggest competition is NMR, not mm-hmm. mass spec. Mm-hmm. But NMR, 2D and multi-D, NMR just creams infrared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so infrared was way up there, and they didn't get enough new things, exactly what you said.
Mm-hmm.
But NMR has.
Yeah. But I think still mass spec
keep getting new things.
Mass spec, I still think
mass spec keeps
outdoes NMR. Though I mean, I know that they have been there's been some reasonable progress in that, but it is an interesting phenomenon because people kind of just put it. Well, it's exhausted its utility, and it's just a run-of-the-mill technique, and all of a sudden something happens. And this whole business of being able to get biological molecules of interest to ionize has just been revolutionary. I mean, the ASMS meeting has gone biological. There were 6,000 people, I think, at the last ASMS meeting. You know,
and it's all, and so many of them were interested in and the big argument was top-down versus bottom-up, and we totally lost that argument not too long ago, but now we're beginning to get converts.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. When you say top-down versus bottom-up, we're talking about being able to sequence proteins.
Yeah.
So characterize
proteins.
Characterize. What's the top-down method of doing it?
Well, the big difference historically is that when mass spec first got into the protein business, the standard way for separating proteins was 2D gel electrophoresis.
Right.
And so that gave you a spot, and the biochemist wants to know what's in that spot. And so the only way they could get that spot into the mass spectrometer was to digest it and make it into peptides, and then put the peptides in the mass spectrometer. And so that then became the standard way to examine proteins.
So by obtaining mass spectra of the digested proteins, digested as peptides, as small fragments of the protein, that provided sufficient information for them to determine the nature of the protein.
Yeah, well, there are two problems in proteomics. The first is just to identify the protein. Now here you have the advantage that the DNA sequence has predicted what proteins will be generated, and so you have a few thousand to pick from. And so if you find a peptide, let's see if I can do the statistics. If you find a hexapeptide that has six amino acids,
mm-hmm.
and you actually can get the sequence of those six amino acids, there's only one chance in 20 for each of them, because they're 20 different. And so you have 20 to the 6th power uniqueness of this protein, of this peptide. And if you then look at your thousands of proteins that are identified and see if you can find this sequence of six amino acids, and you find it in one of those, there's a pretty darn good chance that just by identifying this hexapeptide that you've identified the protein. And so but the trouble with that is that you also would like to know about this, that the genome only tells you the sequence. It doesn't tell you about post-translational modifications.
Okay.
And so to find that out, finding this hexapeptide and identifying it, it's very, unless you develop very specific methodologies, what they do with bottom-up is that they sequence all the peptides they can,
mm-hmm.
but they don't worry about the rest of them.
Okay.
And in fact, in shotgun sequencing, they digest a big mixture of proteins,
mm-hmm.
and they just look for individual peptides, and they know that there are going to be lots of peptides in there they can't identify, they can't do anything about, and they don't even worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the peptide happens to have the part of the protein that has the post-translational modification, they're not going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, top down, first you've got to get the whole protein into the mass spectrometer,
right.
And the reason that that's the gel electrophoresis doesn't stop you now is that you separate proteins by liquid chromatography.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you want to do top down, and now you get the molecular weight of the protein. In fact, you get.
So when you say molecular weight, we're talking about 10,000 Daltons, 20,000 Daltons, 100,000 Daltons.
Fred's spiel. Fred has just started into his spiel.
Oh, I'm in trouble.
Well, I think if you... Here. Top-down visualization of a protein mixture.
Okay.
Here are 14 different molecular ions from a mixture, and you can see we're doing the molecular weights of these to a Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
So here's 14,712.2, and that should be... it's not 14,714 or 14,710,
mm-hmm.
And we can worry about accuracy. But this is our old 6-Tesla instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you can, these are all inside the Fourier transform instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can do Alan Marshall's SWIFT and knock out all of the ions except 14,712,
mm-hmm.
and then we can break it up.
Mm-hmm.
We can break it up by shining the infrared laser on it, or we can break it up by collisions, or we can do electron capture dissociation,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get pieces of the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's one. This one is 20,211.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out if you look at the different proteins that are possible, there is one, this is 20,211.3, there's one 20,211.9.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hopeful, but mm-hmm. it could be a coincidence. And so here's, you do this SWIFT on it, here's the molecular ion that you get with all
mm-hmm.
the others gone,
mm-hmm.
and you break that up and you get these things.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, between this peak and this peak, there are 57 Daltons.
Mm-hmm.
Between this one and this one, there are 57
mm-hmm.
Daltons. That means there's glycines there, because
mm-hmm.
glycine, here's one that's 146, so that's phenylalanine.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get the sequence from this thing just by getting these pieces of the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, and you look at the sequence that is in this 20,211 guy,
mm-hmm.
and it's the same sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know you've pinned it down.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not only, if you had gotten this peptide by digesting it, then you would know that you had, that would be your evidence that this was originally this protein.
Mm-hmm.
But this protein has exactly the same molecular weight, and so it doesn't have any post-translational modifications.
Right.
And so now you pin the thing down much more.
But this is a really itsy-bitsy, teensy-weensy peak here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, signal to noise,
I mean, there is something there, but it's pretty small. So I need to get some copies of these to go with our with the transcript, so people have some idea what it is we're talking about.
Okay, you may have copies of any of these.
Okay.
Here's electron capture dissociation, carbonic anhydrase, 29,000.
Mm-hmm.
In the mass spectrum, there are 512 fragment ion mass values.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the tiny peaks, you
you have to remember that we have this tremendous signal-to-noise ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can get masses. We have 512 mass values
mm-hmm.
in this one mass spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And NMR and infrared and those guys just have... They have no concept of what... The record, and do I have it in here? The record, as far as I know, is a mass spectrum with over 5,000 masses in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and these can, and so here, when these are assigned, there are 259 amino acids in carbonic anhydrase.
Mm-hmm.
This represents in one mass spectrum 183 cleavages.
Mm-hmm.
And so as far as finding out about the structure of this molecule, the reason we show it because it's a joke on us,
mm-hmm.
but when the carbonic anhydrase is well known, its sequence has been in the protein databases, one of the first ones that's ever there, and we've always used it as a model for our
mm-hmm.
top-down things. Our first publication on this was 1990. Well, here it is. Our first publication on this was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our pieces fit the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
The postdoc comes in to me and he says, well, I of these 512 fragment ions, 45 of them were off by one Dalton.
Mm.
And I said, well, maybe you didn't calibrate your instrument. I mean, this is 29,000, man.
Yeah,
29,000.
Yeah,
of course,
yeah.
The fragments aren't 29,000.
No, but still.
And I said, he said, but they're all off by minus one Dalton, not mm-hmm. plus or minus.
Yeah,
and,
it's a systematic error.
And then when I tried to explain it, he said, and they're all the assignments are between... the 10 and the 30th amino acid out of 259 amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that the sequence in the protein database had always been wrong, and they had aspartic acid and asparagine are different by only one Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
And so to make this fit, all you do is switch this aspartic acid to this, and this asparagine, and then they all fit. So we corrected the sequence in the protein database, but we'd been using the wrong sequence, and in fact, we have a paper in 1959 that we have top down in the title.
Mm-hmm.
In 1959, whatever. The,
1999,
yes. And you know Neil Keller.
Yes, I know Neil.
Well, and Neil's the first author of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, we were showing how top-down works, and we showed how it worked on carbonic anhydrase. And he said he missed one of the fragments by one Dalton,
mm-hmm.
and of course he hadn't missed it, but at least he reported it honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, this is all Neil's fault, it's not my fault, because he's the first one.
Yeah, Neil talked to our local discussion group a few years back.
Oh, did he?
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So anyway, so this is the top down is far better to characterize the protein, where bottom up is cheap and fast to identify proteins, and it turns out that of course you can identify them by top down.
Yeah.
And Neil's the figures that people usually get is that the identifications by bottom up are 97% accurate or something like that. Neil's program for calculating the probability of his top-down identification being wrong, he comes out with things like one part in 10 to the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the difference. I mean,
sure.
If you've got the molecular weight right,
yeah.
Sure, there's some chance of being wrong. But since our molecular weights, we've already, there are 20,000 possibilities there. You've already, and then the pieces you get, of course, we get many pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's a case where we had 45 masses that told us this was wrong, and though Fred would have ignored one or two, or obviously Fred had ignored one or two, when there are 45, he doesn't ignore
them. Yeah, you can't ignore that. So could it be that the bottom-up is driven by people who come out of the biological community who are used to working with gels and are trying to adapt mass spectrometry from that perspective, whereas the top-down people are mass spec oriented and think more in terms of creating the ions. I mean, that is almost always a fundamental desire, I think, of any mass spec person, is to create the molecular ion. I mean, that's why people like Fab for the way that it would give you a nice protonated ion. Chemical ionization provided a means of creating molecular ions for a lot of compounds that were, by electron ionization would just fall apart. But you hear with chemical ionization, you could say, yes, well, there is a molecular ion. It's alcohol. It's a C9 and not a C10 or whatever, So it's that mentality that the mass spec people bring to the biological problem, creating a molecular ion, whereas the biologists are coming from this, pieces.
Mike, you could have said that. Absolutely right. It was the way we had to do this.
Yeah.
And so the real thing we contributed, it was, I named it top down,
mm-hmm.
and I named theirs bottom up, which mm-hmm. has some connotation of being lesser mm-hmm. of lesser quality.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as soon as we did this, it caught on,
mm-hmm.
these really good people that developed the top-down approach, I think they were all at genomics type companies,
mm-hmm.
and so of course that's what they would do,
mm-hmm.
and if they found a method that worked with, even though they had to do digestion to get it out of the spot,
mm-hmm.
if they had a pure protein that came off the column, mm-hmm. they still did it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though you and I,
yes,
especially if we have electrospray and FTMS, and that's
mm-hmm.
the other thing they didn't have. Oh, that's, they didn't have a chance, of course, do this. They all had quadrupoles and ion traps, and,
mm-hmm.
and they had no chance to do this without FTMS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the main thing that we're going to get out of FTMS is enough resolving power to nail down the mass accurately, and there's no ambivalence about it. I mean, one mass unit difference, as you show here, means something that has to be looked into. Whereas in a quadrupole or an ion trap, one mass unit difference would be considered to be quite adequate, or even pretty damn good.
Well, so, and the other thing is that MALDI can't do it, because
mm-hmm.
MALDI, we need to have all of these charges on there
mm-hmm.
in order to do our dissociations. We have to have those charges, and MALDI only puts one or two charges on.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me, I got to get you one more reprint.
Okay.
This is in science, so it's a little harder to get into science.
Mm-hmm.
And that was this fall.
Mm-hmm.
And just to complete the story, the problem we've had with top-down is that as these proteins get bigger and bigger, and we have them stored in the mass spec inside the FTMS, they get harder and harder to break up.
Mm-hmm.
And for years we have been studying what happens to the conformation of the protein when you go from solution to gaseous.
Mm-hmm.
And we started, our first paper was 1993 on HD exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been a lot of controversy about this, and it's not settled at all.
Mm-hmm.
But we have found a way to break up these larger proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not... before, it was very difficult to get any information out of a 50 kilodalton protein or 60 or mm-hmm. something like that. And now we're getting lots of information out of
200 kilodalton.
150 and 229 is one of the largest we've gone to. And it's mostly been through understanding this folding process and the fact that things are the conformations are different in the gas phase than they are in solution.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a nice fundamental study, and it's been there have been, well, the biggest point of controversy is that many drugs act by associating with the enzyme and the protein.
Mm-hmm.
And so you in developing new drugs, they have screening methods. How do you find out which of these small molecules associate with the protein the best?
Mm-hmm.
And so a way they have come up with is to take a whole mixture of these small molecules in solution with the protein,
mm-hmm.
electrospray the whole mixture, and then look at the molecular ions plus the drug molecules are 200, 250, 300,
mm-hmm.
and look for those molecular weights, and the ones that are the largest are the ones that have bound the best.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they bind because of the conformation of the protein,
okay.
is how they bind
okay.
in solution.
But that's
and
conformation
the conformation
solution.
Changes in the gas phase.
Yeah.
And I, of course, have been on the side, hey, fellas, watch out, they changed the gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep selling FTMSs to the pharmaceutical companies. I had a plane ride with Nathan Yates. That's his name. Nathan Yates, who's a Merck. And he's a very nice guy.
Is it Drucker, you say?
Merck.
Oh, Merck.
Merck. And he's a very nice guy. And I said, Nathan, you can't do that. You know that. And he said, Fred, I'm not arguing with your science or anything. He says, but is it true that the conformation changes more in some cases than it does in others? And I said, well, of course. He says, well, what we find is that we use this as our primary screening method, and we want to screen zillions of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we, this can eliminate 90 or 99%, I forgot what number he used, but of these possibilities,
mm-hmm.
and then we can concentrate on those that are left. And sure, we find that many of them are absolutely no good at all, but we find some of them are good.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, you're absolutely right, but we have no screening method at all, and so this method is better. And he had four FTMSs in his lab. And I said, I've got this one old FTMS. You got four. I think he had four of the new Finnegans. You know, Finnegan.
Mass spectrometers are like handbags.
And and the pharmaceutical guys when I talk to them, they all laugh and say, Fred, you're absolutely right. Before, there were scientists who got very angry with me because they were sure, well, there are many papers in the literature that show how the conformation stays the same
mm-hmm.
in the gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that ECD, electron capture dissociation, is a great way to look at the conformation in the gas phase, because it's so crazy, it breaks the backbone of the protein.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's wrapped, but it doesn't break the non-covalent binding. It's so specific for the backbone. If the protein's like this, it'll break the backbone here, but in the gas phase, it's still stuck together.
Mm.
And so then if you bring in, say, collisional activation and break it apart like this, then that piece will fall off.
Mm.
And so we can study what the conformation is by looking at what breaks up, what doesn't break up with electron capture and so forth.
Mm.
And so that's another way we've gotten at that.
So that's kind of weird. In other words, the soft bonds, so to speak, survive.
Yeah, I tell my physical chemist friends they don't know anything about it. I said, non-covalent binding is much stronger than covalent binding.
Yeah, well, it's...
And it's also great because this specificity for the backbone makes it so that it doesn't knock off the side chains.
Oh, okay.
And if you do collisional activation with a glycosylated protein,
mm-hmm.
those side chains fall off.
Mm-hmm.
Or phosphorylated, they fall off.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do it with electron capture and dissociation, they stay on.
Mm-hmm.
And so ECD has become a great method that way.
Yeah.
And we hadn't predicted that, no.
Well, I mean, but that seems to me that's the whole lot of mass spectrometry. It's almost a serendipitous experience. You know, I mean, the thing about the field in my mind is that it just flies in the face of the scientific management concepts that come out of the business schools, where everything has to be managed and you're going to get this result from doing that and so on. There's no room in any of that type of management for the serendipitous outcome, the unexpected result, the ability to follow down a path that's different from the one that you had planned in front of you. And it's such a dull way of trying to conduct science and research, but unfortunately the business management schools have taken over, and you know, everything has to be devoted to a certain plan, and if you deviate from plan, then you fail and you know, you're out the window. And it's just, this whole technique just shows you, flies in the face of that type of management concept and says, you know, none of this would ever have been developed if it had been related to that type of approach.
Another thing on these very tight things that we finally got learned, another breakthrough we had is that I said to the troops, I said, why don't you try adding things to the electrospray solution? And maybe we'll get more charges on it and so forth. And Evan Williams has shown that things like glycerol give more charges. And so I told them these things to try. And they tried them and came back and said, no, we get the same or worse results.
Mm-hmm.
But we're trying other things, they said. And then they came back and said, oh, we've been trying ammonium tartrate, ammonium succinate, and ammonium, what's the other one? Well, anyway, and we get 50% more cleavages.
Hmm.
And my only contribution is that they got so much joy out of the things I told them to try didn't work that they really wanted to find something. And so I said, well, why does ammonium tartrate work? Well, that's your job.
You
and
to,
so this is wonderful. You
have
know?
To do something, Fred.
And so what's going on? Here's this electrospray solution. Here are these great big proteins that are going to fold up and be too tight. Mm-hmm. And how is ammonium tartrate doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Mike, I need
well,
help.
Well, don't ask me. You're looking at the wrong fellow, man, let me tell you.
And one of the reviewers wanted the paper turned down because I hadn't explained how ammonium tartrate worked. Well, ammonium tartrate, that doesn't make any sense. He has to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I think you and I believe that a good result is really important, and right. if you can explain it also, well, that's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
But
yeah. really amazing.
50% more cleavage.
Wow.
And so I've got the current troops are supposedly trying all sorts of other things that we theorize what the mechanism
mm-hmm.
is,
mm-hmm.
and so far, ammonium tartrate and succinate and whatever it is are the best.
Well, amazing. So this all just came out in the science paper last fall.
October.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to do one or two things before we wrap up here. We've got a little bit of time.
Shoot.
One of which is I'd like to discuss Carsten Reinhardt's book a little bit.
Oh, sure.
This came out last fall a little bit. In the book, he does a very good job, I think, of tracing the history of the analytical techniques involved primarily...
I think he did a great job.
Mass spec and nuclear magnetic resonance. And he does this by, you know, looking at the careers of some pretty influential people, you being one of them, and Klaus and Carl Gerasi being the others in mass spectrometry. And I guess that's okay. It's certainly a way to approach the topic, but I was a little bit disappointed on the mass spec side because he neglected to discuss anything about the impetus or the input or the... of the mass spec meetings, the STM meetings and the SMS meetings. It seems to me that while certainly, you know, these developments have been led by these individuals, but the meetings also bring people together, and then even in the earliest ASTM meetings, which are really run under more or less a kind of engineering aspect, there was a group of people that were interested in pursuing fundamental aspects of what's happening in the ion source when you do electron ionization on a molecule. And so he does allude to some work that Cy Myerson did, but which was really important work. But there's a lot of, like, for instance, Frank Field and Joe Franklin and Bert B. Munson, and he mentioned something about Rosenstock, but only in one, you know, only one reference. There's a whole cadre of people that were working in this area doing various other aspects of it, getting mass spec away from this analogy where you describe as a dry ice, banging a piece of dry ice in a bag and just breaking it up into random fragments, and then actually developing an understanding of how electron ionization fragments these molecules. So I guess that's I felt that he kind of did maybe missed something that he should have had in the book. I don't know if my criticism makes any sense to you or not.
Well, I think that he thought. I agree with you that I think he was perceptive and seeing this development of instrumentation. As a totally interesting scientific phenomenon that hadn't really been recognized sufficiently, at least in print, with a book that summarized it and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that by bringing more than one method in together, NMR, especially NMR and mass spec, complement each other so beautifully, and their developments were competitive, but really much more complementary. And the fact that NMR got better helped us to sell our better things. He has quite a bit in there about how much more trouble we had selling mass spec to chemists and biochemists than NMR people did.
Mm-hmm.
Though they had some trouble, but we had a terrible, terrible time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that he never set out to give proper credit to all of the people that his book, well, he couldn't have given proper credit to all the people in mass spec without making the whole book on mass spec.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in that as in most cases, we need to give him credit for what he accomplished.
Okay.
And for not what he missed. But as far as what drove this whole thing and what made it possible, I think my contributions are really very different than both Klaus's and Carl's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I was interested in very different things.
Sure.
Than they are. Or you can put it another way, I'm a much worse organic chemist than either one of them. That's another way to put it.
Yeah.
But as far as the meetings are concerned, I totally agree with you. The meetings were the most important thing of all to me. I've only missed one meeting. I've forgotten which one it was,
mm-hmm.
59 or something like that. And the reason for that is that I, as far as these things that I've done, these come out of ideas that I've collected by knowing all these people, by talking to all these people. And sure, I haven't given them enough credit for the ideas I stole from them, but my only defense is that we almost never hid anything.
Mm-hmm.
We always talked about it at these meetings, mm-hmm. also, and I conversed with all of these people, and well, you brought up the LCMS interface thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting after meeting where we would get together with Marvin Vessel and Don Hunt and lots of these good guys, and we'd discuss how are we going to do this LCMS coupling,
mm-hmm.
and well, my method was the first real commercial method that worked. Hewlett-Packard did my method,
mm-hmm.
Or the one with Mike Baldwin,
mm-hmm.
that we did published in 1983,
mm-hmm.
and that worked,
mm-hmm.
and as you say, there were also it worked better than that's right. Its competition was the moving ribbon,
mm-hmm.
and it worked better than the moving ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
It was where we did chemical ionization with, mm-hmm. the solvent out of the LC solvent as the chemical ionization,
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but of course, when electrospray came along, who would ever use our method?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we at these meetings, we had all sorts of fun just kicking the thing around. And I don't know who had got the patents or anything else out of these things. And we really didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
This Cornell patented our LCMS interface,
mm-hmm.
and got money from Hewlett-Packard out of it, which was nice. But mostly. Well, Electron Capture Association, we did not patent.
Yeah.
And I've had people in industry say, gee, why didn't you tell us about this? And I'd say, I did. I went to the meeting and I talked about it. You never came up to me and said you,
mm-hmm.
wanted me to patent it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's better this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really better this way, that as far as my reputation is concerned, everybody can use ECD and nobody is trying to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you do feel that
I got away from the question.
All sorts of people
didn't get credit,
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, but I mean the meetings did play an important part in the evolution of mass spectrometry from the beginnings into where it is, the analytical technique it is today.
For me personally, there was nothing more important. I went to every single. Well, I missed one. Because I had to do something in Dow, I forgot what it was. around 1960. But I went to every one of these. I went to every single one of the international meetings.
Those are triennial?
What?
Those are triennial?
The triennial mass spec meetings. The first one was in London in 1958. I told you that's when we went up to see John Bynum, and, and Al Neer and I were the official U.S. representatives, and British there was a formal banquet, and the we had to wear tuxes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the I'd never been to a British formal banquet, and what they do, but anyway, there after the toast to the Queen. There are responses to the toast, and Al Neer was the first one, and he said some very nice things about being there and so forth. Well, it and then the second guy, and who, well, doesn't matter. The second guy, what you're really supposed to do is tell stories, tell jokes, and the second guy told. And the Brits, of course. So John Biden's the best storyteller, and so and he had these marvelous stories. And so I'm next. And hell, my platitudes that I was supposed to say, and I came up with one joke that got a good response, and I forgot what else I did. But you know, I was just totally overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I was just a green kid from Nebraska.
Yeah.
And so anyway, when John Bynum had the meeting in Swansea in 85 or whatever it was, he said, Fred, we never get many people from the U.S. And that was true. And he says, you have to do something about this. And so I know people at NSF, and they have a, and I got the a thing to support young people to go to that meeting, and I think we supported 50. That was a large number.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so I got out applications and everything else, and I had a committee to pick who would be, and we tried to. And I think the figures were that the previous time there had been 30. U.S. or we had included Canada, North American people at the meeting, and this time, although we only sent 50 on this thing, there were 180 because all of these guys that applied and gals that applied to us when and we had I think we had 150 applications, almost all of them. Went someplace else and got the money. And John, the Biden's, he's terrific. You know, he comes up with these great ideas.
So the international meeting, is it as important, and I suppose it should be, right?
In that was, for me, it was always an entirely different view of mass spectrometry. They have their perspectives in those days. I mean, the world's much smaller now, and there aren't as big a differences. But in those days, their perspectives were very different than ours. And I, well, Victor Talrose, I got acquainted with him long, long before that. And
how do you spell Talrose?
T-A-L-R-O-Z-E.
He's from Russia, right?
He's from the Institute of Chemical Physics in Moscow. And Victor is the guy who invented CH5+ in 1952. 1952, and I was at Dow, and this publication came out, and since I was mass spectrometry, my organic friends all over said, you mass spectrometrists, you're the only ones that can make carbon not tetravalent. Haven't you heard, Fred, that carbon's tetravalent? Oh, I got all sorts of garbage. And Victor, of course, the Russians had reasons for Americans not to like Russians anyway. And I got acquainted, I forgot when I first met Victor, but I always thought it was great stuff and tried to, though I didn't do the theoretical calculations. And so the kinds of things that he was doing and the kinds of instrumentation he built, that influenced my work tremendously. I felt I could, I don't know all 6,000 people, but I used to know everybody in St. Louis.
Yeah, well, I give it up on that. It's hard.
But it was great fun, I like to tell the story that one of these international meetings, a young man came up to me and asked me about the database, of reference mass spectra, and I said, "Boy, if you have any, we'd love to get them," and things like that. And I don't know if I'm ruling. The next meeting, 3 years later, this young man comes up to me, and he looked vaguely familiar.
Sure, I know.
He says, "Do you remember what I promised you 3 years ago?" And I said, "No, I don't." "Well, here's a floppy disk with 5,000 reference mass spectra."
Uh-huh.
And, that's a nice gift.
Oh, yeah.
That's a nice gift, yeah. Especially when NIST has only collected 193,000 in the last 40 years.
Yeah. So the conferences then, both of them, the American and the international conferences are...
And Klaus used to go to all of them, but Carl hardly ever.
Well, I don't know, like Carl, I don't really consider him to be a mass spec person per se, in the same sense that you and Klaus are.
He
used the technique and did a lot of good stuff with it, and it was very adventuresome, but he's more of a... entrepreneur person, as I see it, as a
has more money than I do.
Well, it's more money than a lot of us have. Like you say,
I like Carl.
I mean,
I've always had a wonderful relationship with Carl, and he contributed. Well, he as much as anybody changed the organic chemist's opinion of mass.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, the stuff he published with Butzikiewicz, they worked together, didn't they? Butzikiewicz and Gerasi.
What?
Butzikiewicz.
Oh, a bunch of Cavitz.
A bunch of Cavitz.
Yeah, those books and theirs were great.
How do you spell that? I bunch of Cavitz. B
U D Z.
Z-I-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z. Yes, Butzikiewicz. Okay. Butzikiewicz. Yeah.
And I'll tell you where the computer that came from. Carl, of course, had a running his master truck, but he wasn't letting the students touch the instrument. My students have to take care of it. And he came to me and he says, "I've been trying to find a job. And Carl really wants me to stay here, and I suspect he's not recommended. And so I found a good job back."
Hey, there you go.
I helped.
So if he was operating the instrument, did he have a degree, or was he just...
Oh, he had a PhD back in Europe.
Yeah, okay.
And was on a postdoc. And so was Dudley Williams.
Okay.
Oh, and Dudley is terrific. And Dudley went to Cambridge, of course, and was a big help in popularizing mass spectrometry. And he's never gotten the credit he deserves.
Well, it's hard. I mean, there's so many people who have done so many things. It's kind of hard to acknowledge them all. We can't really criticize, Reinhardt for not writing the book that we thought he should have written, but or writing about what we thought he should have. But, I think the meetings were definitely a big fertile ground where people, where ideas came together and people were motivated to try different things and go off and do things.
Why did I go to every meeting? Because, for very selfish reasons, Well, I enjoyed the people. I enjoyed stealing their ideas.
Yeah, a friend of mine once mentioned that he'd gone to Europe, England. He'd gone to work in, for a pharmaceutical company in England. At that time, the meeting rotated, you know, East Coast, Midwest, West Coast. And so his strategy was, since he had gone to England, he would come to the East Coast meeting, which was every third year. And after I saw him, that after that arrangement, he said, this isn't working because too much happens in 3 years for me to miss this meeting. So he had to change his strategy. So what I'd like to do then is I'd like to just run down a list of names of people that have been in the field and get your impressions or thoughts about them and what you think they contributed. So one of the first is Cy Meyerson. You know, you've known Cy, I'm sure, for many, many years.
But, well, as I told you, I knew Cy not only through the Pittsburgh Conference and ASTM, but we had this Midwest Spectroscopy group meeting, and that when I was at Dow in Midland, that from 50 to 56, and so, well, that's more than 50 years ago, and Cy was always interested in more than just getting the analytical samples run, and he worked with Paul Rylander, and Paul was also a very good organic chemist. Though Paul, I think Paul, very soon after they published the paper on the tropiliamine, and one, they had follow-up papers too. Paul had took a different job in the company and got out of the mass spec lab, so that. And I didn't know Paul well, size guy I usually talk to, but I think Paul had a real contribution to this too. But Cy was a fixture at meetings, and Cy's contributions in this. I have a book with an early book with chapters in it.
This is it, and so of the people that I thought were doing really, they're silent. So I had all of these people write for it, and that's 1963, I think.
Yes.
63, and so those were the people that I thought were, who would also write the here's a chapter by Archie Hood, and he worked with Jack
Sharkey.
No, Jack
O'Neill.
O'Neill, and so this chapter will tell about the direct probe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the book is Mass Spectrometry of Organic Ions.
I tried to get O'Neill to write it, and he turned it over to Archie.
Well, you know, that's a bit of a chore.
Jack by then was up rather high in the company. M.J. O'Neill it is, Junior.
So the fact that you included Cy in when you put that book together is a testament to how well you thought of his science.
How about Cy? His science. His science was great, and the tropilium ion. For them to be organic chemists enough to recognize the argument in the fundamental science of organic chemistry, the tropilium ion was a brand new concept, argument, and
very important to physical organic chemists, and yet somebody running samples for a petroleum company, how could that affect them?
Mm-hmm.
And they picked up on it and and knew that their instrumentation could look into that.
Mm-hmm.
They showed that the deuteriums were scrambled,
mm-hmm.
and that that fit the mechanism, tritium ion mechanism, and I think it was wonderful.
Oh yeah, that, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, as you had said before, in industry, it's very hard to find time to do such things, except that back then it was easier than.
Oh yeah.
It became harder as the years went by.
Yeah. So what about this fellow Maynard Hamming? Do you remember Maynard Hamming?
He worked for me.
Oh, okay. Was it at Dow?
I think he was the first guy I hired at Dow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so maybe it was 1952 or 1951 that he came to work for me.
Oh, my. Okay.
After I left Midland to go run this lab, he then went to work for somebody in the Pittsburgh area, not Alcoa, but, and then he moved to Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kept track of him all those years, and he was anything. I hate to discuss personality. He was a wonderful person,
mm-hmm.
and a tremendously hard worker,
mm-hmm.
and tremendously committed to things, and didn't seem like an academic type at all,
mm-hmm.
Except that he just was so pleased to get to work at mass spectrometry and so appreciative and
mm-hmm.
all of these things. And yet he always came to meetings, and he then ended up writing books.
Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable to me,
mm-hmm.
that he was so dedicated at all of these things. And he was a real fixture in mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
One of my earliest papers on the McClaffrey rearrangement with isotopic labeling,
mm-hmm.
was due to Maynard. We always called it Maynard.
Mm-hmm.
That he had found that Herb Brown at Purdue University, the Nobel laureate,
mm-hmm.
had made these esters with with the deuterium labels on it,
mm-hmm.
and he had gotten the samples from Herb and had run them on his 103,
mm-hmm.
and I think he was still in Pittsburgh then, whatever this company was,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote me about it, and he couldn't interpret the spectra, I shouldn't say he couldn't, what he couldn't do, but anyway, he wrote to me for help, and then I was very excited because it fit into the McClaffrey rearrangement beautifully, and we published it in Applied Spectroscopy or something, not very, but anyway, as far as the record is concerned, it's probably Happen Stewart actually did one in 1952. In which they labeled butyric acid, so I'll take it back. Only they didn't call it the McClaffrey rearrangement.
Yeah.
And you know why they didn't?
Yeah.
Because McClaffrey hadn't done anything on it.
Yeah. Always helps to have something named after yourself. So what about guys like Frank Field and Joe Franklin? They were really, I guess, they were doing.
Well, the two they worked together at Humboldt, and were tremendous in sort of the physical chemistry background of things.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Franklin always was that way when he went to Rice University, and his and his academic research program there was based on that.
Mm.
And of course, Humble was wonderful in giving freedom to do those kind of things. Frank Field had much more to do with chemical ionization than Joe, though they both came out of the same sort of work together. And Frank went to Rockefeller and had an NIH facility there and really did a great deal for establishing relationships with Rockefeller, one of the finest biological research institutions in the world. And of course, he got Brian Chiat to come there, and Brian has made it into one of the finest biological mass spectrometry labs in the world, even though he's a physicist also. But Frank Field was a towering figure. He's as tall as Mike Grayson.
No, he's taller than Mike Grayson.
And
if he was staying out in the hall talking, we'd be able to record him here.
And Frank, well, what you say about meetings, Frank was always a real presence at meetings, and he was always contributing to the discussions and in a very positive. Frank could say things like they were really true, and he made it a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's not the kind of guy you think you'd want to get in an argument with unless you were really, really, really firm ground.
Well, I always loved, and I was on Frank's advisory board there, and I'm on Brian's too. I guess I've been on the advisory boards of most of these. Never Klaus's.
So these are the research resources that NIH
resources.
And so
Kathy's, Kathy's.
Were you very well acquainted with Brian Green, the fellow at AI?
Yeah. Of course, I didn't see as much of him, but Brian, I thought very highly of Brian. First thing that came to mind was that I. When was this? I was giving a talk in England, and I got a note from Brian saying, "Fred, I want you to stop over to our factory. Our last four sector instrument is on the line. It's number 110, I think it'd be appropriate if you would be here to see it come off the line." I was giving a talk nearby, and I never got over there, and I should have. But our four sector instrument that we built here was the first one, and Veitch got into it and built a very fine instrument. And Klaus had, I think, the first of theirs, or almost the first of theirs, and they were, I think, $1.5 million apiece.
Oh yeah, these things were getting pretty pricey.
And I was totally floored. Maybe he called me. Maybe that was it. He called me because I said 110 at $1.5 million apiece. Well, he said, we sold some of them for less than that. And I said, you sold some of them for more than that too. Well, if you put on the automatic Martini maker.
Yeah, right.
And so I was. Brian. That group that, and what you had, the way it evolved through all sorts of companies, but they were very, very clever,
Brian was behind a lot of that.
And Brian was a big part of that. He sure was. No, wonderful guy.
Did you actually have an opportunity to interact with or meet or talk to Harold Wiley of CEC?
I didn't know him personally as well as others at CEC, but those very first meetings, Harold Wiley was always there, and the one that kind of he didn't run them. He was always a dominant figure, but there would be 40 people in the mass spec group at the first couple of Pittsburgh conferences mm-hmm. I went to, and Harold Wiley, and he was very nice to me. Was, mm-hmm. Of course, I was a potential customer,
sure.
and he had to be nice.
Yeah. Well, my recollections of the earliest ones I went to is that they were obviously a lot smaller, but also the hospitality was flowed kind of freely in those early ASMS meetings, and so I suppose that people got together and interacted in a very loose way.
and their earlier experiences to me were always fascinating, the way CEC did mass spectrometry and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have a real relationship with him.
Okay. But you did know, meet him and interacted with him.
But I, yeah.
What about Matsuda in Japan?
He's the first time I visited his laboratory, his instrument had just gotten up to, what was it? It's so hard with FTMSs and resolution to keep things straight now. But for it was, this was in the early 60s. And if you want a date on it, it was, I would guess it's, now I'm trying to guess. I think I was still at Dow. Hmm. I think so, let's say 63 or something like that.
Okay.
In Osaka. And the year before, so you can date it that way, they had a typhoon. The University of Osaka was in downtown Osaka, mm-hmm. which is near the sea,
mm-hmm.
Near the harbor. And the year before, they'd had a typhoon that had put all of his mass spectrometers under 6 feet of salt water.
Mm-hmm.
And to say the least, and he was still mad as hops about this.
I can imagine.
He still, you sort of touch a nerve and he would go on. He was a gentleman, absolute gentleman in every way. But he'd moved to this new lab.
Hang on just a second. My phone's ringing. What the hell's that about?
Oh, it's out of tape.
I want to make sure I get us going here again. Okay, we're going again. Yeah, so Matsuda was upset about this.
Anyway, so he just got his new instrument going, whether it was a year and a half later or something like that, and it had electric sectors and magnetic sectors and great spaces in between, and it had marvelous resolving power, and of course he was running elements,
mm-hmm.
and I've forgotten which isotopes and what elements he and but I got to look through the display of in which they wiggle the lines across the exit slit,
mm-hmm.
that I could see this marvelous resolving power,
mm-hmm.
and I've been back to his lab several times, and he was just a total gentleman. He designed all on the same sort of magnet. Oh no, he had a time of flight that was very.
No.
But he loved to design instruments.
Mm-hmm.
We had trouble with our RMH2,
mm.
and put on a new magnet so that we could get much better performance. And we had Hank Burboom from the FOM Institute, BOERBOOM, Hank, HENK, Boom Boom, terrific guy who was great on sector instruments, came over and spent 3 weeks helping us, and Matsuda then did the calculations for us,
mm-hmm.
Bless his heart, to see what's wrong with our magnets and how we can compensate for it. And so all of this was, he was just a great friend.
Mm-hmm. What about Eyring, Henry Eyring?
I didn't know Henry.
You didn't know.
I met him, but I.
You basically.
But I knew all his students.
You made some contributions to the fundamentals in the fragmentation.
Rosenstock, Warhaftig, Wallenstein, and Eyring.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know Wallenstein, but Rosenstock and Warhaftig, I knew extremely well. Mm-hmm. Very well.
Well, I know Rosenstock went to, and both Warhaftig went to ASMS meetings. No, Rosenstock did.
Yeah.
He was an officer, I think, at one
right.
time. As a,
and Warhaftig stayed at the University of Utah and was crippled, but great mind.
Mm-hmm.
But Henry Eyring, his contribution of the quasi-equilibrium theory was a great contribution to making mass spectrometry real chemistry, where everybody, well, the canvas bag theory,
mm-hmm.
you heard the canvas bag theory,
mm-hmm.
it's like when you break up dry ice, you put it in a canvas bag and hit it with a
mm-hmm.
mallet. Well, that's what most people believe, and quasi-equilibrium theory helped destroy that.
When did he do that? You know?
When did he?
Yeah,
do
when
that?
Did, yeah.
In 55, mm-hmm. something like 1955, I think was his first publication. 54, maybe.
Burnaby Munson.
Burnaby! Oh, I still. Burnaby was at the last meeting. Oh, I knew him. Well, he started coming to the meetings. I met him through Frank Field and Joe Franklin,
mm-hmm.
and I remember when he went to Delaware, and I've seen him at every meeting, and had a nice chat with him at the Seattle meeting, he's been a great figure in mass spectrometry and just sort of a stabilizing force. His contribution of chemical ionization was terrific. And as a switch to academe, he helped academics love mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Keith Jennings, we mentioned him yesterday.
Oh, Keith's an old friend, great friend.
Now, is he, what is he doing? Where is he? Is he in the, he was in
he's
the
UK. At Warwick.
At Warwick.
University. He's been there a long time. He was head of the department chair for many years. He did the first collisional activation. What we call collisional activation, what many people call collision induced dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I think his publication ought to beat ours by several months.
Mm.
He was always much more a physical chemist, but his contributions to the understanding of this are tremendous. And he was always a presence at meetings and important person for committees. And he hired Peter Derrick to come. I knew Peter Derrick very well, because he was a starting assistant professor in Melbourne when I had a sabbatic there in 1976,
mm-hmm.
Jim Morrison was chair of the department, and Jim was my old friend from way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim was very busy with administrative things, and so I'd eat lunch with Peter every day, and we were building this four-sector, or planning this four-sector instrument that
mm-hmm.
was the, really the first one, and they were building a monster double-focusing instrument,
mm-hmm.
Jim Morrison contributed to the design of it. They were very helpful, but Peter Derrick then went to Warwick, and so Warwick has been a big name in mass spectrometry,
mm-hmm.
because of Keith, and later Peter Berry.
Gene Futrell.
Gene, I was so glad you had Gene Futrell's tandem instrument. I forget about that because I visited Wright Field and saw his instrument, and he actually worked there with the. You have to give credit to somebody else that was there, Tom Tiernan. Tiernan was there and got Gene to come there, and so I think it was really Tom Tiernan and Gene Futrell that did it. But it certainly was the start of Gene Futrell's career on doing these things, and he went to Delaware, and he was much more interested in the fundamentals of the collision process and finding and using the tandem instruments to elucidate this. And then, to our surprise, long after many of us moved, he moved to Pacific Northwest Labs, a very important position there, and he stepped out from that too. But he's always contributed to fundamentals in an excellent way, a great friend, and of course he was president of the ASMS and those kinds of contributions.
How about John Finn?
Ah, John! He's great.
Did you know John until recently, or I mean?
I knew him. I can't say that I really knew him before he talked about electric spray at ASMS.
Mm-hmm.
But I immediately forced myself to know him. But as I say, he contributed greatly to our first use of electric spray on the FTMS, and he was totally helpful. And Craig Whitehouse, his student, that set up a company for electric spray.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Whitehouse, Whitehead. Anyway, my brain. He let Craig tell me everything, and John told me everything, and John, actually, I think one reason that I kind of hit it off with John is that I knew Malcolm Dole from way back.
Okay.
And I gave a seminar when I was first at Purdue, let's say 1966 or something like that, at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm Dole had this crazy idea. And he was having trouble getting funding from NIH. And I wrote to NIH. I said, this is the greatest idea since sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you said, why did he have trouble? Well, the reason he had trouble on his Bendix time of flight is that he electrosprayed 100,000 molecular of polystyrene, is that how do you detect the ions? They're going so slowly when they're of that mass that they don't knock out any secondary electrons. And so he had to do this all with a Faraday cup.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got data that showed he had things, but the data, the signal to noise, data was... So, in case you want an answer to your question, so Malcolm Dole, I kept track of Malcolm, and used to see him at meetings, too. Mm-hmm. And, of course, John Fenn gives Malcolm Dole lots of credit also.
Yeah.
John's great.
Dole didn't go to ASMS meetings, did he?
Oh, he was at... I think he was at one or two early meetings. Anyway, I used to see him places.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was ASMS.
Okay.
It could have been at other places.
Graham Cooks.
Oh, Graham Cooks. Oh, Graham, I love. I first met him... he was a student of Dudley Williams. I met him through Dudley.
Okay.
And he went to Kansas State, and I knew him there. I had something to do with him, even at Kansas State. He was very good at talking to people, and very fun guy to talk to, mm-hmm. full of ideas, and everything else. And of course, when he went to Purdue, I had to know him.
Oh, yes.
I had to know him. And he's always been very nice to me. You know, Purdue, I tried very hard to get my stuff away from Purdue, and I really didn't think I left any bad feelings, but Graham Cook's always worked very hard to make sure that I knew that there weren't any bad feelings back at Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And no, I've tried very hard on getting honors from Graham and things like that. I certainly think he's
a very productive scientist.
Very one of our proudest products.
Marvin Bestel.
Oh, Marvin! Oh, he went to Purdue.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he got a master's degree from Purdue. Marvin did. Marvin actually worked on the quasi-equilibrium theory. Early on.
Okay.
With Henry Rosenstock. And I think that's what he did his master's degree at Purdue on.
Hmm.
Though I can't remember just who he did it under.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but this was before I was at Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't work for me or anything like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then when he went to Houston, he went there he was at Utah. Yeah, he worked on the quasi-equilibrium theory at Utah. He didn't get a PhD at Utah. He finally got it at University of Houston or something.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many years later, he got a divorce or something that he needed to leave
mm-hmm.
Utah or whatever. But he was always, always doing something different with instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what was it when one of the early competitions of how we're going to do LCMS, and he had instruments in Texas. He was doing it one way on the time of flight and another way on the quarter pole, and then he started his own his own company down there, and he had. And he had instruments galore, and of course, when he finally sold his company, he moved to Framingham, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where I had my Dow lab.
Oh my, that's crazy.
And he hired one of my good students, Paul Davis, and things like that. So, yes.
What was the name of the student?
Paul Danis, D-A-N-I-S. Paul was the guy that did neutralization reionization with me. That's a method we didn't talk about, but I love methods, and that's one that's still used for fundamental studies by people like Helmut Schwarz
mm-hmm.
and Frank Turicek and Chris Westemiotis, who both worked on it with me.
Frank.
Turicek, T-U-R-E-C-E-K.
E-C-E-K.
E-C-E-K.
E-K, okay.
E-K. Actually, it's Frantisek. F-R-A-N-T-I-S-E-K.
Frantisek.
Okay. What do you call it? Czechoslovakia.
And the other West.
Priest West Demiotis?
Yeah, West.
W-E-S-D-E-M. I-O-T-I-S.
Chris. Chris Westemiotis.
Yeah, he's at University of Akron, and Frank's at Washington University, the other University of Washington.
Okay. There's Washington State, and well, actually, there's a lot of schools.
You're at WashU.
The Washington University.
It's University of Washington.
Okay.
In Seattle.
Yeah, this Washington State or Washington University gets confused with a lot of schools. Al Neer.
Al Neer. Well, I think I already told you about Al. That Al I knew early on, and then Al. I certainly knew him in 1958, the time we went to the meeting together.
Mm-hmm.
I went to his 70th. I helped organize his 70th birthday party, his 75th, and his 80th.
Okay.
And let's see. I remember Mike Gross having a symposium in Lincoln, which he got Al Neer down. Of course, he was from Minnesota.
Sure. Yeah.
Mike's from Minnesota, and I was there. And oh, we crossed paths for many years.
Let's see, I got another name here. Oh, Jack Sharkey.
Oh, Jack, yeah. Jack, Jack was, well, I met Jack the first Pittsburgh conference I went to in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
He and Gus Friedel were at the U.S. Bureau of Mines, A.J. Sharkey,
mm-hmm.
and Gus was the group leader there,
mm-hmm.
and Jack worked for him, Jack, well, they were different people, but they were a wonderful team, and Jack then went on to the University of Pittsburgh, where he was for many years after, I think he retired from the Bureau of Mines.
Yeah, I think so.
But you can do that in the government pretty early.
Yeah.
And he was very valuable at the University of Pittsburgh. And he's, I think I told you yesterday, they were some of the biggest early supporters of doing research on mass spectral fragmentations. They did some of the best early work on that of anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that work also
Gus
came
died,
out.
Gus died rather early,
mm-hmm.
Compared to Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know more about Jack. But yeah, great guy.
So a lot of that fundamental work came out then in those early SPM meetings with Jack.
That's where it got started, and it was a wonderful inspiration for me to talk to these guys. Yeah.
So I have an interesting question to propose to you: is what if you had to pick out the names of five people for oral histories to be conducted in mass spectrometry? Name five people you think would be good to have their perspective on the field.
Well, I think you should pick the oldest ones. get their perspective.
I mean, I know Cy Marson, I've got an oral history on Cy, so that's he's.
Yeah, you told me that. I'm trying to think of some people that. I think you should think internationally, and so of the people, you only have U.S. people. John Bynum absolutely would be at the top of the list.
Okay.
Jim Morrison knows an awful lot about the earlier history. And he's still alive, and we had a Christmas card from him. Though he's interviewing him will be tougher since he's in Australia.
Australia, yeah. Well,
but you didn't ask for limitations,
right?
But he is a very clever guy. Was involved in many of the developments, and is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Vlada Harish would give you interesting things, except he's a very modest person. Well, put him down. He hasn't nearly as broad experience as the other two, because he's always loves Czechoslovakia and doesn't leave and go to meetings. Mm-hmm. I have to always go to see him.
Mm-hmm.
But
how do you spell his last name?
H-A-N-U-S.
H-A-N-U-S.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
But I'm trying to think of people that are still alive that were around for these early Alex Harrison.
He's in Canada, or is
he's
he
in Toronto.
Toronto,
University of Toronto, all these years. So many of these people are gone. Dudley Williams is a guy that wouldn't be at the top of the list, but certainly is highly intelligent and has a perspective on things that is not as prejudiced as people like me.
Okay.
Some of the federal people still have.
What about Frank Field?
Oh, Frank's fine. Yeah, Frank can be fine.
He's kind of interesting.
Frank can be fine.
A while back, maybe 5 years ago or so, you know, we had this local mass spec discussion group that I'm kind of chair.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, it'd be kind of interesting to have Frank just come over and talk about mass spec to the discussion.
Yeah, he's not so far away.
No, but he was like, he more or less divorced himself from all of the stuff, and he doesn't want to, wasn't interested, so I don't know if he'd be interested in oral history interview or not, but it'd be interesting to try, you know. I mean, if he doesn't want to do it, that's fine, but
I would put him ahead of Burnaby Munson.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good list. They're mostly international. I doubt, maybe we can get someone to do those interviews, and it would be really a good idea. So I guess this is your time to wax poetic. What words of wisdom would you want to wish upon posterity? what we're talking about, 60-some-odd years of experience in science and mass spectrometry research.
I guess it's just the research is totally fun. It's a wonderful hobby, and that the people part of it was a huge bonus, and that interacting with most people I found to be open, and I have a guilty conscience that I haven't given nearly enough credit to all the people I talk to, and keeping track of who deserves credit for ideas, but my only defense is I hope I haven't held back in mm-hmm. discussing things with when Mike Bowers got the ASMS award
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago. He mentioned the ASMS meeting in Honolulu, and that something about his most memorable moment for ASMS was that we had a huge argument, and Keith Jennings was the chair,
uh-huh.
and Keith, bless his heart, kept everything under control with his British wisdom and everything else, and we were just after it, hammer and tong about these things. And Mike, I consider to be a great friend. If he's ever turned down my JCS manuscripts because I was such a nasty guy and arguing with him, he deserves to do that. But I think, though people came up to me afterwards and thought that we hate each other, uh-huh. and, you know, we don't hate each other. The whole conference was livened up. Uh-huh. And Keith Jennings used to talk about it afterwards and tease us about this. Mm-hmm. And, as far as I'm concerned, that's what makes science really work, is that we both thought we were right. And
stuck to your guns.
Yeah. And the work I was arguing about was with Myung Kim, who's a professor of chemistry at Seoul National University in
Korea.
And my postdoc I had a few years ago from Seoul National University, the postdoc said, "Oh, Myung Kim did a postdoc with you. He's the smartest person at the university." And he actually came to the Texas ASMS meeting.
Okay.
And he's still doing nice work, mm-hmm. and things like that. But I said to him, "You know, I still think your work was right with Mike." And of course, when Mike talks to me about it, he says, "Well, I'm glad that you finally admit I'm right, Fred." And so, I had a little trouble remembering what we were arguing about.
This, okay.
so that's what I think is great, as long as you can have fun and research and make it a hobby that other people you can work with.
So that would be your recommendation to generations to come?
To argue with Mike Bob.
Argue with Mike Bob. To have fun with the work. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered just about everything that I want to cover, and maybe
that's
a little
great.
Bit more, and I hope that we've covered everything you want to cover. We do. I want to get some copies of things, and then...
when I walk you out...
I think this is the one.